the key is we stand for Alaska first. We stand on our own feet. We are not intimidated by outside forces.
A new political interest group takes shape in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 16th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, at least one brown bear in Anchorage is keeping skiers on their toes.
So if you're out there on the freshly groomed trails that got groomed last night and the only other thing that's been out there is a bear, it's really obvious.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com. And by AT&T, Rethink Possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The mettle of Occupy protesters in Fairbanks is being tested as mercury dips well below zero. The temperature dropped to minus 38 this morning, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Occupy Fairbanks has not been frozen out.
The extreme cold has not deterred a small group of Occupy Fairbanks protesters from maintaining their vigil at a downtown park. Protester Beth Hughes says she's outfitted to continue the effort regardless of how cold it gets.
A down one-piece snow machine suit and my gloves and hand warmers and my Wolverine mittens. I'm ready.
Hughes says she's not about to give up on the Occupy protest, a movement she says she's been waiting her whole life for.
I missed out on the 60s. And with all the people that have been dedicated to this, in the lower 48, we're small here, we're Fairbanks, Alaska, but I believe this is just a ripe opportunity to really make a statement.
At least one Occupy protester has been on hand 24/7 for the last month at Fairbanks Veterans Memorial Park. A few days ago, as the temperature began to dip, they set up a small canvas tent with a wood stove inside. The tent may violate an agreement with the borough that members of Occupy Fairbanks not camp at the park. University of Alaska student Ethan Sinzabaugh says the tent is necessary to maintain the protest.
We were told we're allowed to stay and peacefully assemble and protest and have our signs up and everything, but if someone leaves, then it all has to go down and we have to take everything away. In order to maintain a presence here and to keep warm especially, it's not even to sleep, it's we just need warmth and shelter. And that's why it's like, you know, to deny us this means you're going to take away our ability to peacefully assemble, and we feel that goes against the Constitution.
Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says he's weighing protesters' rights against borough parks and recreation rules.
We have park regulations that say you can't camp, no fires. So there's a balancing here between what people can assemble and they have a right to assemble, but then we also have to ensure that park rules are followed and there's no camping. So are people staying overnight in the tent? Are they warming up? And we got to get that clarified. But a tent sitting there with a wood stove in it, to me, certainly looks like camping.
Mayor Hopkins says he believes the borough has some legal ground to challenge Occupy Fairbanks' use of the park if it violates borough regulations.
People have the right to assemble, but as decisions have been, you know, in the higher court system, is that it can be called out time and space specific. So we have to make sure that there's a clearer understanding than there is right now, I guess, on what can occur in the park.
Hopkins says he plans to meet with Occupy members to talk about the situation. Sinzabaugh says Occupy Fairbanks is not a recreational activity, but an effort to get out a serious message about corporate influence in our political system. He says he feels solidarity with Lower 48 Occupy protesters who have been subject to government crackdowns.
We all have this frustration with how things have been going, and now we're finally taking a stand and watching it get clamped down for various different reasons. It's, you know, we're here to support the movement down in the Lower 48 as well. It's like we want to show them, look, guys, even way up here in, like, Fairbanks, Alaska, right close to the Arctic Circle, we're doing our thing.
Sinzabaugh says he's balancing the protest with a night job in school and is prepared to delay his graduation a semester to continue the Occupy Fairbanks protest. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A federal judge is considering whether the state of Alaska should be allowed to collect additional money for unforeseen damages from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Arguments were heard yesterday over the so-called reopener clause in the billion-dollar settlement over the 1989 spill. That settlement capped reopener damages at $100 million. The state has asked for $93 million. Arguments centered mainly on the distinction between cleanup and restoration. ExxonMobil Corporation argued the state's request was for cleanup and that under terms of the 1991 agreement, it's not liable for cleanup anymore. Attorneys for the state and federal government said ExxonMobil's protection from liability for cleanup doesn't extend to unforeseen damages. U.S. District Judge H. Russell Holland took the matter under advisement. Alaska Congressman Don Young gave Interior Secretary Ken Salazar a piece of his mind on the Obama administration's energy policy today. Young tried to drive his point home by showing up late in the hearing wearing a beanie hat on his head. It was topped by a propeller and sported a pin that said Obama's energy plan.
As you see in my hat that I'm wearing, I'm supporting the Obama energy program. It's that call a propeller. Because there is no energy program.
Young said he's concerned about how seriously the Obama administration will weigh public input on the future of ANWR because he's worried it could sway them against development. Yesterday marked the end of the public comment period on a management plan for the Arctic Refuge. It includes a recommendation that the coastal plain be designated as wilderness. The environmental group Alaska Wilderness League says more than 850,000 people submitted comments to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service asking that it be off limits from oil and gas drilling. And Young says those should not weigh as heavily as the comments of pro-drilling Alaskans.
What bothers me, I understand, is certain national environmental groups have garnered 1 million signatures recommending wilderness status on the coastal plain.
Young said he suspects the signatures go with form letters.
This is 1 million signatures. Are you going to listen to that, or are you going to listen to the Alaskans?
It is very important for us on our entire conservation agenda, Congressman Young, to make sure that we are listening to the local communities. And so Alaska is a world unto itself in terms of its beauty and its potential. And as you may have noted in the Wilderness and National Conservation Report that we sent to Congress, I did not include anything in there on Alaska because Alaska has its own unique set of circumstances that need to be considered.
Secretary Salazar repeated his position that drilling in the Arctic Refuge is, in his words, not appropriate. Salazar was at the committee meeting to talk about the Obama administration's oil and gas plan. Today, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management announced it has the information it needs to begin reviewing Shell's plan to drill up to 3 wells per year in the Chukchi Sea beginning next summer. The company already has conditional approval for a similar plan in the Beaufort Sea. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, planning an Anchorage micro-community that shares space.
Co-housing is if I feel like it and I want to go up to the common house and have a beer with my neighbors, I'll do it. And if I don't, I'll hang out in my own backyard and have as much privacy as I want.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
Former Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams, who was the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate last year, has formed a nonpartisan interest group with the expressed purpose of providing financial support to candidates who commit to putting Alaska's communities and people ahead of out-of-state interests. And the group, named It's About Alaska, now on file with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, is already touching a chord in other parts of the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Scott McAdams says he believes that everything that's done politically in Alaska must be looked at in light of what's best for the state itself. He says natural resource issues come to mind first.
There's going to be a lot of outside political money invested in Alaska, trying to buy our elections in 2012, 2014, and beyond. It's About Alaska will work to elect people who know that Alaska's economy needs new investment in our sewers, in our streets, in our schools, and not a giveaway to outside non-resident millionaires.
McAdam's nonpartisan approach to government is not new in the state. It largely reflects the point of view of former Governor Wally Hickle. Malcolm Roberts of Anchorage, who worked with Hickle, says he was part of a small group that met informally last year to draft and release a statement of principles called the Alaska Agenda, calling for a new emphasis on the state's interests in political activity.
The key is that we stand for Alaska first. We stand on our own feet. We are not intimidated by outside forces, whether they're government or corporate or nonprofit, but we stand together for Alaska.
Robert says he's looking at issues on which most Alaskans already agree: education, the economy, the environment. And like McAdams, he sees protecting those things as a major priority.
Natural resources are the key to our economy. We have a remarkably healthy economy right now compared to the rest of the country. We have a gorgeous environment, I think unmatched. We have all these blessings, but we need to be united to put Alaska first and to make sure that special interests don't dominate us.
Neither Roberts nor McAdams is opposed to resource development. However, both emphasize the state must focus on watching out for its own interests. McAdams says he hopes to be involved at the ground level of political campaigns to help candidates spread their messages.
When somebody does stand up and say, our resources need to be developed for the benefit of people in Wasilla, our resources need to be developed for the people in Turnagain, our resources need to be developed for the people in Ketchikan, not that our resources need to be developed to create a profit margin for a multinational corporation.
Both are working in a nonpartisan fashion, but Roberts is not critical of parties. However, he says he has not heard a drumbeat from either major party on issues he thinks Alaskans want to work on. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A couple of hundred people packed into the Sutton Elementary School in the Matanuska Valley last night to make their feelings known about a proposed coal development in the area. The Department of Natural Resources Division of Mining, Land, and Water hosted the public hearing as part of the permit renewal process for Usabelli Coal's Wishbone Hill project. The proposed coal mine is located in an area with a long history of coal mining, although more recently, a residential community has grown up there, and conflict between the two seems unavoidable. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Department of Natural Resources officials extended the meeting by an hour to accommodate as many speakers as possible. The testimony was about evenly divided between supporters and opponents of coal development. Many homeowners along the road system near the mine area are caught between concerns about health and environmental hazards and a need for jobs and community economic stability. Usabelli Coal has applied for a standard 5-year renewal of its Wishbone Hill mining permit, which the company has held since 1997, says Usabelli External Affairs Manager Lorelei Simon.
And our company has actively maintained those leases and permits since then.
Before that, the permits were held by other companies, and much of the environmental data supporting the permits dates back to the mid-1980s. That fact provided a target for mine opponents like Carly Weir. She says environmental and human health impacts need another look.
There are over 100 families that live within 1 mile of where this mine would be located. I mean, driving here, the winds were crazy. I can only imagine the toxic coal dust that will blow through the valley on nights like tonight if this mine is permitted.
The project in the Matanuska Valley is now in its exploratory phase, but if Usabelli decides to move forward on it and the state approves its permit renewal, Simon says mining could start in about 18 months. While some property owners don't want industry so close to home, many in the community welcome the mine. Chris Gates lives near Sutton.
There's a very small number of things that make sense to do in Alaska. Coal mining is one of them, and coal mining here is especially one. We've seen it work well here. Our state constitution expects responsible resource development. There's not a good reason not to open this mine here. In fact, it's very well suited. Please allow this mine.
And the Sutton Community Council supports the mine project. Conversely, members of the Chickaloon tribe were outspoken about the mine's presumed impact on their nearby land and on children who attend a tribal school. Chickaloon Village Traditional Council's Indian Child Welfare Case Manager Penny Westing predicted negative social impacts.
As people become worried about not having clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and land to recreate on, as well as provide sustenance for their families, they'll become depressed. The divide between neighbors, lifelong friends, and family members is ever increasing between the anti-coal and the pro-coal ways of thinking.
But Sutton's Roger Purcell says he's been to Healy to check out Usabelli's coal mine there, and he said that the coal company has done a good job at reclaiming the land. Lorelei Simon says Usabelli is getting a lot of community support.
Not just in the Sutton area, but certainly borough-wide. We've had a number of people call the office, come to the office, send us emails, and express their support, and a lot of them are looking for jobs.
Usabelli says the mine will provide 75 jobs, but Jeremiah Millen, executive director of the land use group Friends of Mat-Su, says the mine will only set a precedent for all Alaska.
The location where it's being proposed here is just not feasible, and it's a full-on residential community, and you can't put a strip mine and smack dab in the middle of a residential community.
Millen questioned the validity of Usabelli's current permit. The hearing lasted 4 hours and marked the end of the public comment on the Wishbone Hill permits. Russell Kirkham, manager of the state's coal regulatory program, said it will be 60 to 90 days before a final decision is made on the permit renewal. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Archaeologists working at Cape Espenberg at the northern tip of the Seward Peninsula have discovered the earliest bronze artifact found in Alaska. The find raises questions about possible international trade hundreds of years ago. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The small object appears to be a buckle and was found in August in a Beech Ridge dwelling that was occupied by Inupiat. The buckle was likely made somewhere in East Asia. It appears to have been made in a cast, which was a technique not known in Alaska at the time. Owen Mason is a research affiliate with the University of Colorado Boulder and one of the principal investigators on the project. He says there's been bronze found in northwest Alaska from 19th century Russian whaling activity, but this piece is much older.
Centuries long before any Russians or British or American whalers were in the area.
A small piece of leather wrapped around the buckle shows a radiocarbon date of roughly 1400 years. The object predates the homes at the Cape by a few hundred years. Mason says the buckle was likely used in East Asia to fasten items to a horse. In Alaska, it could have had a spiritual significance.
It doesn't seem like it was a clothing fastener. It might have been part of a shaman's garb. There was an interest in having kind of noisemakers, if you will, things that would rattle in the wind. It does have that hook, and it seems like it could be attached to clothing.
The foreign-produced object raises questions about the possibility of advanced trade and commerce in the region. Mason says the buckle could have been brought by residents when they arrived at the Cape, or it could have been acquired through trade across the Bering Strait.
Now, the other possibility is that there was a series of trading episodes between Bering Strait and its place of origin. And, you know, other objects and other trade items were passed many times between groups, several groups that we are uncertain about. And perhaps something like walrus ivory was the original item of trade from Bering Strait that would reach China or Korea that was of interest to folks down there and was a trade item for the bronze piece.
Another possibility is that it came directly from East Asian traders in the region, but Mason says there is no evidence of long-range maritime activity. He says the wood evidence around the Cape does not show any signs of a shipwreck. The research team was in the third year of a study funded by the National Science Foundation to learn about how people responded to a warmer climate around 1,000 years ago. One big question at Cape Espenberg has to do with whether people were whaling at the site.
Our big challenge here is to see if the whalebone that we see on the surface there is actually telling us whether people were whaling right at Cape Espenberg. I mean, we know from other sites that there was whaling going on, you know, at Cape Prince of Wales, perhaps at Cape Krusenstern, but, you know, Cape Espenberg is pretty shallow, so even though we've got whalebones in the houses and there's a fair number of other whalebones in the trash mounds around, we're still not totally convinced that there was whaling going on.
Mason says people from Cape Espenberg may have joined whaling crews from up the coast and brought back bones from the hunt. Mason says there is no digging plan for next summer, as the team will be publishing results of their excavations. They do have plans to give a talk in the Nome area early next year. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
This evening, a group in Anchorage is hosting a gathering at the Anchorage Museum to discuss their plans for creating a co-housing project in the Anchorage area. The concept isn't new. Tonight's speaker, Charles Durrett, has designed more than 50 co-housing communities throughout North America, and he lives in one with his wife and 33 other families in Nevada City, California, near Lake Tahoe. Terry Pauls is a longtime Anchorage resident and is working on the local co-housing project. She joined Durrett in the studio with me. Charles Durrett is quick to say co-housing is not a commune, but rather a place to better know your neighbors while still maintaining privacy when you want.
We just crafted a new neighborhood together. Interestingly enough, it has nothing to do with what regular neighborhoods look like. You can't drive, you know, there's a few cars that are close to the houses, but most of them aren't. And then that we have a large common house. And we actually have dinner cooked in the common house 6 nights a week. And, you know, my wife and I show up a couple times a week. You know, pooling our resources, we have a fantastic swimming pool, for example, for 34 houses. Over and over again, we have things that we could never afford on our own. But when you pull your resources, amazing what you can do, you know. And the way we pull our resources is, for example, for 34 houses, we only have one lawnmower, but we only need one lawnmower. So, you know, we save money in lots of areas, and then we buy things in other areas.
Is there a philosophy about the mix of income, or how do you go about figuring out who you want to be in this neighborhood?
Our position is like with the 24 households that started the Nevada City co-housing, you know, we had folks, probably half of them had never bought a house. And we've actually did a project not long ago, 26 houses and 23 had not bought a house. So unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, quite often we're trying to really squeeze the budget to make it doable for folks who hadn't actually owned a house previously. That's not always the number one reason that people get involved. I mean, most people get involved for lifestyle reason, you know, a functioning neighborhood. What's unusual about co-housing is that the disparity of incomes involved. I mean, we did a project in Boulder a couple of years ago where there's 6 houses that cost $125,000, which is practically free in the city of Boulder, and 4 houses that cost $750,000. So, you know, basically, it's whoever comes to the table, we try to make that work for them.
Terry, where are you looking for property, or do you have property now?
Well, we're looking actually all over the Anchorage Bowl area. So that can be quite a process. But I did want to speak to our desire to have different levels of housing available in terms of the income level. And we've talked about the possibility of renting as well to make it possible for really anyone who would want to live there to be able to do that. And when you keep the cars on the periphery, what that allows is for this whole kind of park-like landscaping to exist between the homes. And you can get to a house just by walking down a pathway, not even having to walk onto a street. The most recent one I visited in Bellingham, I just happened to be walking off the deck of the common house, and there was a guy setting up all this equipment. I asked him what he was up to, and he said, well, I'm going to be brewing beer here with a bunch of my buddies. Do you want to see how that happens? And in talking with those folks, they said that was one of the best things they loved about co-housing, was the things they could learn from each other.
Do you have a legal structure in place? Is it some sort of an association, or how does this work that people would sort of co-own this area?
Legally, it's set up like a condo association, in that the people own everything inside their walls, and then they get to jointly take part in the decision making for what happens everywhere else. In co-housing, people have a pretty deep intention to know their neighbors, and that includes usually having a common house that includes a big kitchen, often commercial type kitchen, and a big dining area. And there are common meals 2 to 3 to 6 times a week. And it's really breaking bread together that I think makes co-housing stand out as a way to be able to form these deeper relationships.
Charles Durrett is a co-housing community developer, and Terry Pauls is an Anchorage community member. The presentation is tonight from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Anchorage Museum. Once the snow flies and the skis come out of storage, most Anchorage residents expect bears to be asleep for the winter. But this winter, at least one brown bear, likely a boar, is still roaming the hillside area. Substantial bear tracks have been spotted on some of the popular cross-country ski trails there. And the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage Ski Conditions Forum is buzzing with posts about the bear. Anchorage area biologist Jesse Coltrane with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it's not unusual for brown bears to be awake this late.
While we do see bears up later into the season and into November and even late November, we typically don't have a lot of bear activity in town during by the mid-November on. So that's what's a little bit unusual about this year. Even though bears may very well be up into late November, we usually just don't see them in town at this time.
Coltrane says easy food sources like outdoor trash and backyard chickens can convince bears to delay hibernation. And she says both have been problems on the hillside recently. But she also says the early snow cover this winter may make it seem like the bear problem is worse than it really is. That's because bear tracks in the snow stick out like sore thumbs.
I think what's really dramatic right now, too, is that if you're out there on the freshly groomed trails that got groomed last night and the only other thing that's been out there is a bear, it's really obvious. Whereas in the middle of the summer, there could have been 10 bears that walked that trail before you hit it running that day, and you'd never would have known it because they didn't leave any tracks.
Coltrane recommends carrying bear spray while skiing, but she hopes the current cold snap will help prod the bear into turn in for the winter. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Sutton, and Ben Matheson in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.